Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org and thanks. Quick, before this podcast starts, take 90 seconds and help pay for it. Public media is funded by the public. Contribute at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's tax day and the start of a series on the effect of the GOP tax bill. Bloomington's Andy Strenz is mixed about it.
I hope it works great. I hope the whole thing goes over exactly how they planned, and I hope it makes the economy churn. I hope that they prove me wrong.
Listen to Ryan Denham's report as GLT follows four households through the tax year. It will be different as the new tax law begins to take hold. Meet a painter of presidents who talks about the character he finds in their portraits. GLT's Judy Valente interviews Chaz Fagan about his exhibit at Eastland Mall. And GLT's John Norton tracks down a jazz dignitary playing at Illinois Wesleyan University. All of that and a GLT news update on the way. It's April 17th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Today is tax day, the deadline for Americans to file their federal taxes. The new federal tax overhaul has added many new wrinkles to this dreaded annual tradition, and the bulk of the law isn't even in effect yet. Lawmakers have made bold predictions about how the new tax law will impact middle American and middle income Americans. Here in Central Illinois, there's still healthy skepticism about the bill and what it will mean. Over the next year, GLT will follow four individuals and families, a widower, a local business owner, a single 20-something, and a couple with kids. We'll check in with them periodically as the tax bill impacts their paychecks, their employers, and many other parts of their lives. GLT's Ryan Denham has this first story in our tax overhaul series.
It's business as usual at Andy Strand's Key Shop in Uptown Normal on a Wednesday afternoon. Andy owns Bill's Key and Lock Shop with his dad, the store's namesake. They have 10 employees, and Andy says it's not really a small business in the traditional sense. It's more of a micro business.
Oftentimes, the micro businesses or the mom and pop type of stores just kind of get lost in the fray because these big deals that politicians tout really don't speak to them. It's more these intermediate corporations.
Andy and his wife, Marie, live in Bloomington with their two kids, ages 6 and 2. Marie is an operations analyst at Midwest Fiber Recycling. Andy runs the family business. They were both skeptics of the federal tax overhaul when it passed Congress in December. She thought all the tax breaks were going to go to big companies and the wealthiest Americans. Andy was also lukewarm. He grew up in a Republican household and is a small business owner. The tax plan is supposed to help small businesses, lowering individual tax rates and providing an additional 20% deduction for companies filing as pass-through entities. But Andy thinks it might ultimately be a wash, costing a bit more in some ways, but saving him money elsewhere.
I hope it works great. I hope the whole thing goes over exactly how they planned, and I hope it makes the economy churn. I hope that they prove me wrong, and I hope that it puts more money in our pockets and it makes life easier.
Most Americans are seeing lower taxes as a result of the new law. Here's President Donald Trump speaking right before it passed.
That's why our tax plan will reduce taxes for our middle class and allow them to keep more of their own money, keep that hard-earned money where you can spend it the way you want to spend it, or guess what? You can also save it. Nothing wrong with that. But it's your money, not the government's money.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who grew up in Bloomington Normal and now represents a district in northern Illinois, said on the House floor that the tax law will create new jobs.
And according to the Nonpartisan Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, 85% of Illinoisans will see a tax cut next year. And the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation has estimated that the state of Illinois stands to gain tens of thousands of jobs from this reform.
But for Marie Strenz, so far, the new tax law isn't making much of a difference in the family budget. She saw her paycheck grow by about $15 a week. She jokes that she's pouring that right back into the economy at the Coffee Hound.
The benefit to us so far hasn't been anything substantial when they kept saying, oh, this is great for everybody, and you're going to have so much more, you know, money available, and it's just not the case.
Andy and Marie say their household budget considerations are bigger than $15 a week. They've got a rental property that's been a challenge to keep occupied. And health insurance is the real biggie. They pay $135 a week to insure their family of four. Andy's shop offers health insurance to its employees, but they're paying more and getting less and less.
In order to make it still able to cover the costs, we're having to chip away at benefits and things like that within their health packages. So it's getting rough. And that's next to withholding and things like that is our just most intense bill that we have to cover here at the shop is our employees' health care.
Tax time can get complicated for Andy and Marie. It's a little bit simpler for Dylan Mayer, a 22-year-old Illinois State University employee from Normal. He's working his first job since graduating from college, out on his own for the first time. He gets paid once a month, and he's noticed an extra $80 or so in his paycheck.
Well, like, I guess sometimes whenever I tell myself that I should eat in or maybe not buy something, like once in a while, I think, oh, well, I have this extra $80, so why not? But that's only when I need the extra push, I think. I think more often than not, it doesn't really affect the money that I'm spending or anything like that.
Dylan grew up in McLean, a small town just south of Bloomington Normal. His family's conservative, though he moved to the middle himself when he went to college. He's voted in both Republican and Democratic primaries.
A lot of times when I talk to people about what I think in policy, my Republican friends think I'm too liberal, and my Democratic friends think I'm too conservative.
The average household will get a tax cut of around $1,600 this year. But to help ensure their bill met the budget limits that Republicans had set for themselves, lawmakers set many individual income tax changes to sunset after the year 2025. Yet they made cuts to corporate tax rates permanent. That means come 2025, middle-income taxpayers like Dylan would see their taxes go up unless Congress acts again. It's an issue Dylan was watching as the final bill won passage.
And it feels like if they were really concerned with people like in the middle class, or at least in my situation, they would have done that the other way around, where cuts for the middle class lasted for a longer time and cuts for businesses and corporations were reevaluated later.
Cindy and Kevin Gann are even more skeptical. Cindy is a business analyst at State Farm. Kevin is a software developer. They live in Bloomington with their two school-aged children. The tax bill lowered the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. That's one of the reasons many larger companies offered headline-making bonuses to their employees soon after the bill passed. Supporters of the tax rewrite say it will help business owners invest back into their business and potentially hire more employees. Kevin Gann isn't buying it.
I'm a software person, and I've been laid off enough times that I have the realization that companies are about making money. They're not about making me feel good. They're not about paying my bills. I'm responsible for that kind of stuff, and I just don't see that making companies richer is going to benefit my children in the long haul.
Kevin is also worried about the long-term impact of the $1.5 trillion tax cut on the federal budget. Earlier this month, the Congressional Budget Office forecast the return of $1 trillion plus annual deficits and a ballooning public debt that will approach $29 trillion by the end of the next decade. Kevin thinks those deficits could be used in future fights over spending on social safety net programs.
If there's no funding for social programs in the future, you can't have any, and then somebody's going to have to pick them up. And it's going to be easier to make the argument that they should be privatized, and that's how I feel about it.
His wife, Cindy, says she was very skeptical when it first passed, and that hasn't changed now that her paycheck is reflecting the new lower individual tax rates.
And I looked to see what the difference was with my withholding, and it was like around $30. But you have to realize, too, like I said, my health insurance goes up a little bit every year, so next year that $30 is going to be gone.
Health insurance is also a top concern for Mary Kay Kosher of El Paso. The 58-year-old was widowed 3 years ago. She's since gone back to school at Heartland Community College to become a nurse. She's working part-time now and is paying big money out of pocket for health insurance.
It's been very expensive, and I've had to continually downgrade my coverage just to keep the cost constant. And I think it's going to get a lot worse because we're going to be losing some of those plans from the Affordable Care Act that really help people that were in those lower income brackets.
Mary Kay owns some farmland with her sister, and she itemizes her tax deductions because of her charitable giving. She doesn't expect those things to be impacted. But she recently asked her tax preparer to crunch some numbers about what the new law will mean for her. The answer has her watching her spending very closely.
I've always been a cautious person, but I do look at each purchase a little more carefully and see, is it something I really need? Is there something that I could do for better value, that type of thing?
Mary Kay sees herself as politically moderate, even fiscally conservative, though she voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
I just feel that right now, the GOP and the Democratic side, neither one are really seeing what the average hardworking citizen needs. They're kind of going off in their own agendas.
Mary Kay will graduate from Heartland in May as an RN. She'll then enroll at Illinois State University to pursue her BSN. We'll follow Mary Kay and the other voices you heard in this story throughout the next year or so. We'll ask them about their household budgets, their jobs, their businesses, and their health insurance, and how they're being impacted by this expansive legislation. I'm Ryan Denham.
Many thanks to Andy and Marie Strenz, Cindy and Kevin Gann, Dylan Mayer, and Mary Kay Kozier for participating in our tax overhaul series heard here on GLT's Sound Ideas.
GLT comes from the Mike Thornton Agency, presenting the Capitol Steps, Orange is the New Barack, at the BCPA, 3 o'clock Sunday, May 13th. Known for putting the mock in democracy, the Capitol Steps bring tears of laughter through musical and political satire. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Passing a state budget is arguably the most important thing the Illinois General Assembly does every year, or at least should do every year. After last year's drama, when a two-year standoff ended with a Republican revolt against Governor Bruce Rauner, it's an open question about how things may go this year. IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey answers a few simple questions, including, will there be another impasse?
The question may sound simple, but the answer, like most things in state government, is complicated. Lawmakers took a long break from Springfield for the primary election and the usual recess around Easter and Passover. As session resumed this week, I've been asking everyone I can.
Do you think there's going to be another budget impasse this year?
That is the question.
This is State Senator Chapin Rose from Mahomet.
No is the short answer to your question. But I think the next question you should ask is, will it be a 12-month budget? And I'm less convinced of that.
Rose is a Republican, and he and some of his colleagues have been repeating this message, accusing Democrats of wanting only a short-term spending plan. The idea, Republicans say, is that Democrats hope to retake the governor's mansion this fall, then pass the kind of wild tax hikes and spending that Republicans say Democrats would love to do. The thing is, when you ask actual Democrats if they'd prefer a half-year budget, they too are speaking in one voice.
No, we've been consistent in saying we need a full-year budget.
This is Representative Greg Harris. He's from Chicago, and he's one of the House Democrats' top budget negotiators.
I don't know why the Republicans keep fantasizing about a six-month budget, but they do. Maybe it's wishful thinking on their part. I don't know.
It's worth pausing here to remember this is not just a political fight. People who are outside the Capitol building have been trekking in to remind legislators of the dire consequences in the last budget stalemate. And they're warning that could happen again if there's no agreement this year. Among the institutions most hammered were Illinois' public universities. At a recent Senate budget hearing, University of Illinois Vice President Barbara Wilson talked about a faculty brain drain linked to the impasse.
You may know that we've become a little bit of a poaching ground for many of our peer institutions who have noticed our reputational hit and who have come after a lot of our talented faculty.
Wilson says they've even learned of schools that have set aside money to specifically target U of I professors. Other state universities say the lack of state funding, and not just during the impasse, has left buildings crumbling. Elaine Maiman is president of Governors State University in the south suburbs of Chicago.
In my 11 years as a president, I haven't seen any money for repairs.
Despite that, Maiman says GSU cannot wait to repair its roofs, so it'll have to issue bonds to raise the money it needs, but even that is contingent.
We've been told loud and clear if there's no state budget by May 31st, we're not going to have that avenue. So there has to be a state budget.
Which brings us back to the question we started with. Will there be a state budget this year, or another impasse? I thought the last word on the subject should go to one of the people instrumental in ending the last impasse, State Representative David Harris, a Republican from Arlington Heights.
I don't believe we'll have an impasse. I believe that by the end of this session, we will have a budget for the new fiscal year.
Harris was among the 16 Republicans who broke with Governor Rauner to help Democrats raise taxes, pass a spending plan, and end the impasse. He says the dynamics have changed from last year. Because of that vote to raise taxes, this time no legislator will have to make that politically difficult choice. And Harris points out that the governor's own budget proposal counts on money from that tax increase. So, with 7 weeks to go in the spring legislative session, the consensus under the dome seems to be that no, there will not be another impasse. Then again, a few years ago, no one predicted Illinois would go years without a budget, and we know how that story ended. I'm Brian Mackey.
Charlie Schlenker talks with State Senator Jason Barrickman about the budget and other issues tomorrow at noon and 6 p.m. during Sound Ideas here on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. A teacher shortage remains a pressing problem in Illinois, and lawmakers are trying to address it by, well, making laws. IPR Sean Crawford talked with education reporter Dusty Rhodes about some of the proposals active in Springfield this session. Rhodes says there's a lot of bills in play.
I've got maybe half a dozen on this list in front of me, and those are just kind of the highlights. Like, there's one from Representative John Cavaletto, a Republican from Southern Illinois, that would basically require every public college in the state to offer a three-year teaching degree. The programs would have to be approved by the State Board of Education, but basically you could go to college for 3 years and get a degree that would qualify you to become a classroom teacher. So there were, you know, a bunch of the universities opposed it, but they didn't testify in opposition to it. Southern Illinois University was in favor of it. That passed with not a single question. It passed committee with not one question. He doesn't have any co-sponsors, but, you know, it's gonna proceed through the process.
Well, we've seen a lot in the news recently about the salaries of teachers in other states, especially. There is some publicity going on about legislation that would raise the minimum salary in Illinois.
Right. That's from Senator Andy Menard, Democrat from Bunker Hill. It would raise the minimum salary to $40,000. Would you like to guess what the current minimum salary in statute is?
I won't hazard a guess.
Oh, come on, come on.
$20,000?
$9,000. Oh. $9,000. I think it was set in like 1980, so maybe that was like the price of a brand new Pinto. I'm not sure.
And to be clear, most teachers earn above that amount.
You know, I ran the spreadsheet recently, and I think there were a bunch that were $26,000. So yeah, they earn more than $9,000, but still $26,000. It's kind of tough.
So what are the odds of this piece of legislation that Senator Andy Menard is pushing? What are the odds of that passing?
You know, I honestly don't know, and I've been asking some of my smartest sources, and they don't know either. It's going to be interesting. I'm going to definitely keep an eye on that.
There's also some other legislation that's out there that's worth a mention as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the State Board of Education is kind of banking on this reciprocity bill so that teachers from other states, currently they have to go through a bunch of testing to get an Illinois license, and this would, you know, allow them to trade in their old license for a new license here. But it would also create a new license called a short-term substitute so that all you need is an associate's degree or 60 hours of higher education to become a short-term sub. It also would allow teachers who have retired to come back to the classroom as long-term substitutes, without jeopardizing their retirement benefits.
So, Dusty, if these don't solve the problem, what else can be done?
I'll say Bob Pritchard, Republican from Hinckley, has a bill that would kind of incentivize students who had been English learners to become bilingual educators. But even though that bill had a lot of bipartisan support, it got killed in subcommittee that same day that Democrats killed a lot of bills. But there's a mirror bill in the Senate that has survived, so that might go forward. They're trying to address the areas where we have the biggest teacher shortages, and bilingual education is definitely one of them.
IPR education reporter Dusty Rhodes talking with IPR's Sean Crawford about proposals to address problems created by the teacher shortage in Illinois. There remains a national shortage of classroom educators as well. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Highway Chevrolet Buick GMC in El Paso, serving business owners and agricultural professionals across central Illinois, offering new and used cars and trucks and a certified GM service center. More information at highwaychevroletbuickgmc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
As a three-year contributor, I'm asking you to become a first-year contributor. I'm Susan DiGennaro. There's a great deal of buzz around this perception that the media cannot be trusted or that they have a distinct bias. Well, if your media source is owned by a company or has stockholders, then the answer is yes. I would say they have a bias. With GLT, the majority of funding comes from individuals or local businesses, a community supporting the reporting. Join me in contributing during the GLT Fund Drive and help pay for everything GLT does with your first-time contribution. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
For just $5 or $10 a month, you can help pay for the reliable news and smart entertainment you expect from GLT and NPR. It's an easy way to get started as a GLT supporter, and it takes just a minute to set it up. Start your monthly contributions now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The majority of people released from prison eventually end up back behind bars. Research shows one way to stop that cycle is through educational programs for inmates, and prison libraries support those efforts. But as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, for all of last year, the Illinois Department of Corrections spent less than $300 on books for its prisons.
We work out of a church. We rent a couple of rooms, and they've been very generous in letting us use additional space.
I'm spending the afternoon with Chicago Books to Women in Prison. Half a dozen women are sorting and taping up boxes of books in the basement of a church. They're one of a handful of volunteer groups dedicated to sending reading material to people in Illinois state prisons. And that's because if they didn't, many inmates wouldn't have access to those books.
It could even be the case that in a roundabout way, the books that we send to women are actually stocking the prison library more than their budget will allow.
Illinois prisons are required to have law libraries, but that's not what Chicago's BWP president Vicky White is talking about. She's talking about general libraries, places where inmates can read fiction and nonfiction. Megan Maurer is a former prison librarian at the Robinson Correctional Center in southeastern Illinois. She says state prison librarians, well, they have no money to buy those kinds of books with.
I can confirm that there is no budget for the general library in Illinois Department of Corrections, at least as of when I left about a year ago.
And the data backs her up. Last year, the Illinois Department of Corrections, or IDOC, spent less than $300 on books for educational programs across more than two dozen correctional facilities. Compare that to the roughly $750,000 IDOC spent on books every year during the early 2000s. That's according to documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. The drop-off in funding could be costing the state more in the long run. Research shows education programs reduce recidivism rates, and libraries play an important role in that work. Lois Davis researched prison educational programs for the nonprofit RAND Corporation.
We showed that for every dollar that a Department of Corrections invests in education programs, they can save up to $5 in reincarceration costs.
Maurer, the former Illinois prison librarian, says books can help people develop a plan for what they want to do when they're released. That's what Julius Mercer did. Mercer's life spiraled out of control due to undiagnosed mental health disorders and substance abuse. He was sent to prisons four times between 1994 and 2010.
With a criminal background like mine, it's hard to get a job.
How can I still flourish?
During his last stint behind bars, Mercer decided to change his life. He started writing, and then he turned to the library where Maurer worked.
I was able to put a plan by reading these business books on marketing and stuff. And I told Megan Maurer, when I get out, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to speak, and I'm going to get my book going. I'm going to get it self-published now, and that's what I did.
Despite Maurer's efforts to make the library the best it could be, Mercer says the collection was lacking.
A lot of the books are antiquated because it's the least of their priority. So they provide just enough to meet the standard and not go over their budget because they want to use their money elsewhere. But the lack of education opportunity for a lot of inmates will keep them screwed.
I reached out to IDOC for an interview. Instead, they sent me a statement in response to my questions. They confirmed there's no specific appropriation for library reading materials, but they offered no explanation for the steep decrease in funding for books since the early 2000s. Maurer, the former prison librarian, says the state prison system does care about education and reducing recidivism, but they have to cover the cost of health care, clothing, and meals for inmates. It adds up.
Then there's the library and, you know, we don't get a budget.
IDOC says they partner with public libraries and groups that donate books to inmates. But Vicky White, the president of Books to Women in Prison, says all volunteer groups like hers can only do so much.
We can't reach everyone and we can't provide the complete level of support that is needed out there.
White says they'd love to close their doors and give away all their books if the system no longer relied on donations. But without greatly increased funding to improve libraries and education programs, she says they'll continue to do what they've always done, send books to prisoners. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas, there's an art to painting U.S. presidents. No pun intended. Chaz Fagan has depicted all of them, and he says showing the character of each individual is sometimes a tough task. There's an exhibit of the North Carolina painter's work at Bloomington's Eastland Mall. C-SPAN commissioned the portraits for a series it aired on American presidents in the late 1990s. Fagan spoke with GLT's Judy Valente about his love of presidential history and some of the surprising discoveries he made trying to depict each of these history makers.
So start with the earliest presidents, and there you can collect a limited number of portraits that exist of them that were painted from life, put them all together side by side, and try to see what the guy might have really looked like. And I thought that would be the hardest part, and when I get through that, it would just be smooth sailing because we have photography that came in. And it was right up until, I guess, it became the invention of the flash bulb. Because with photography, the early photographers were true artists and really setting up beautiful lighting and showing the shape of the face, which is the key for the artist for me. So the earliest photographs were beautiful, and they were able to tell me a lot. The more modern photographs with the flash, eventually the flash became located on the camera. And so if you can imagine you're flashing a light, like flashing a flashlight at someone's face directly, you're not really seeing the shape of it. Whereas if you have an angled light off from the side like they do in movies, you can really see the shape and topography of that face and figure out, you know, what it is. So it turned out that the more modern presidents were the most difficult. We got too used to photographs. The flashbulb deleted all the shapes. And then, you know, we got used to candids and you know, interrupted moments where they're speaking and, you know, things like that. Not the classic pensive moments.
You've described yourself as a presidential nut or aficionado. How did you get interested in the presidents?
I grew up in Europe as a kid, so inevitably you become much more patriotic and proud of your own country's short history.
Where was that that you grew up?
In Brussels, Belgium. The presidents themselves, just as a collection of people, that's just the nature of our system, where we have this election, and then the person rises and becomes known and becomes voted in, and next thing you know, you have a brand new character, and it's usually every 4 or 8 years. It's incredible. So in terms of gathering a collection of people and personalities, the 40-some men that I got to paint were fantastic.
Did you, in the end, feel closer to some of the people that you painted than others, and for what reason?
I know for sure that I have a great fondness for President Taft now.
Why is that?
And that is, well, during that process, C-SPAN wanted to see some of this done live. So on the day that they came to my little upstairs studio, I happened to have Taft up. It was his turn. So he was the one that I had to paint live on TV.
So that's why you remember him.
Yes, and then the humor of it, too, because the room was so small that the poor camera guy had to be in my closet, so, you know, artist utility-type closet. So, you know, I was painting this little face, and that little face was looking back at me, and all I could do was think of the way they described his, you know, bubbly, giggly laugh that was so contagious. So, just one of those great memories.
I want to ask you about that. Did you feel that you portrayed the personality of some of these presidents as well in your portrait? So how did you try to do that?
Well, in general, for any portrait painted or sculpted, that is my absolute goal, is to try to capture the personality. You know, in reality, these little portraits, and they are little, that was the benefit at the time of knowing that they were just for television and nothing else at the time, not exhibit, was that I could work fairly small and have a big impact.
So, for example, what traits did you try to bring out in which presidents?
Well, obviously, the one that, you know, you can associate with just because of his personal history was Kennedy, and trying to kind of convey some of that tragic story. So it wasn't jovial or anything. There's not a little bit of that Taft smirk going on. Things like that I tried to be conscious of.
What about Lincoln, who... you know, there's such iconic portraits of Lincoln. How did you deal with that?
Fortunately, in that era, it was perfect. The presidents became photographed with daguerreotypes, etc. So there was actually quite a quality of images to use. And what I remember with Lincoln, I've since painted Lincoln and sculpted Lincoln too. And at that point, I did not have the benefit of the life mask that I do now of Lincoln. But the one, again, it came back to humor. The one thing I remember most about researching Lincoln was his sense of humor. So he's supposed to have this wonderful dry sense of humor that could come out any time. So I wanted to make sure that the Lincoln that I was going to paint for C-SPAN was not the severe one that we think of, even in Lincoln Memorial, in certain lighting. It looks very severe and stern.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm here with Chaz Fagan, who has painted the portraits of all 45 presidents. Did you learn something interesting about some of these presidents in doing the research and then try to bring out that interesting, surprising aspect in your portrait?
I know the one that I loved, well, there are two of them, I guess, and they're tied together in time, sequentially and consequentially, is William Henry Harrison.
So who died in office and spent rather a short period as president?
It was about 30 days.
Right.
Yeah, no, that story, of course, is the one that is interesting. As a result, there really weren't that many photographs of him. And I found a fairly good daguerreotype, and then I realized that, oh, yeah, it looks like every other artist who's painted him has used the same thing. You know. But in his case, yeah, he decided not to wear that top coat in the cold March day at inauguration to show how young he was, and that was not good.
He caught pneumonia and died.
But his successor is the one that got interesting in terms of, you know, we think of plastic surgery today and airbrushing on a computer. There were daguerreotypes of Tyler, so John Tyler. And there were also some beautiful engravings, so I was looking at everything I could. And the engravings were particularly nice because they had nice shading, and I was thinking of using one exactly because it was just so good. But then there was something wrong, and it was his nose. So I guess, I don't know if it was requested or not, but the engraver altered his nose quite a bit and made it much more of a button nose or something, whereas he actually had the reverse. He had a very strong, remarkable nose. And that was very clear in the daguerreotype. So I ended up going back to true history and painting him as he really did look.
Who was the hardest to paint?
I had hard time with President Carter, trying to get, you have to find images of that era. He's obviously been photographed a ton since his presidency, but I was looking for that particular time period.
Right, because he's obviously doesn't look today as he looked when he was president.
He's a very recognizable, handsome man, but not as he did. And so I had to search and search and search, and I did have a very difficult time. But the result, I did what I thought I would never do, which was actually paint a smiling president. The idea of a portrait is trying to have that interpretive face. So a face where you can look at it and you can see some humor, perhaps see some deep thought at the same time, but you can bring to it what you wish. And the smile kind of negates that a bit. In that you have a person looking back at you smiling, and therefore you can't think of anything serious, or that he's thinking anything serious at the time when you're looking at him.
Is that the reason not to paint the presidents with a smile?
Yeah, I mean, just on a personal basis. I tend to do that in general when painting or sculpting people, because it allows so much more interpretation. You can interact with the person, you know, hanging on the wall or standing in an atrium or something, so much more if you have a mix of expressions that you can find as the viewer. With a smile, you're just left with a person smiling, and there's no interpretation left. But with President Carter, the best images by far were the smiling ones, and again, remembering that time period well myself, that was very true. The image that was portrayed of him was the constant smile.
Did your own politics ever enter it into it? I mean, I might have some difficulty if I were an artist having to paint some of the presidents I didn't particularly care for.
there's always something you can relate to or hang your thoughts and theme on if you can, but no, my goal was really just trying to represent them, the faces, trying to, for C-SPAN, the goal was to have all these images be very consistent, so that you see that continuity of our history with all these people and all these transitions of power, but you still have the continuity, and that was my goal and aim.
Final question. Did it occur to you while you were doing these portraits that there was something that was missing? There were no females?
Well, definitely. And you couldn't help that. But I have to say, I think the C-SPAN has added details of the first ladies, things like that added to the panel describing the president and his term. But as to all men, there's I had no choice in that. History does, but that'll come in time.
Chaz Fagan is the portrait artist who has painted the portraits of all 45 presidents. Thank you so much for talking with me.
It's wonderful to be here.
I'm Judy Valente.
The traveling exhibit of Chaz Fagan's American Presidents is on display at Eastland Mall through June 28th. Although there have been 45 presidents, there are only 44 portraits. That's because Grover Cleveland held the office for non-consecutive terms. He was both the 22nd and 24th president of the United States. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
I give to GLT because of the local news. I've become so dependent on that to really give us a good overview of the issues that's happening in the community. I just trust GLT and NPR.
I give to GLT because I trust GLT to give me the information relatively unfiltered that I need. I really depend on NPR mostly for my basic news information. So if I want to understand more about the current Russia probe, for example, I'm going to trust what I hear on NPR more than other outlets. And just news in general. That's what I really depend on GLT for.
Like, okay, what happened today? You know, what happened this afternoon? What happened since I drove here this morning? It's, just anything, you know, White House related. Mainly that's it. I'm just always ready to hear what the next big scandal is going to be. I trust public radio and GLT to at least tell me without shouting, you know, what the details are, the true details. I'm Kathy McLean.
I'm Fred H. Smith, and I'm a GLT financial supporter.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Pitts, a financial contributor since the early 1990s, and I'm asking you to make a first-time contribution. Do your part to support GLT.
Click on donate at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. Musicians Glenn Wilson and John Dirth say they're always looking for and instilling a sense of authenticity for their jazz students. Wilson is a baritone sax player and director of the jazz program at Illinois Wesleyan University. Dirth is a trumpeter and director of jazz performance at the University of Virginia. They're longtime friends and colleagues. Dirth is the guest artist with the jazz ensemble tonight in the school's Westbrook Auditorium in Presser Hall. Both joined GLT's John Norton to talk jazz and education. Somewhat surprisingly, Wilson says he doesn't consider himself or Dirth to be educators.
We're just old musicians who want to bring everything we've learned in this business to a younger generation and inspire them to play some music. So I don't really consider myself an educator, although I do have a degree in music education, but there are some fantastic
You're the head of a jazz program. You're an
well,
educator.
Well, that's true. I'm an educator, but I'm an educator in a musical format.
And John Dirth, you're the you're an educator as well, director of the jazz performance at the University of Virginia.
And I actually like the point that Glenn is trying to bring out here, because the fact is, nowadays, I'm really much more interested in exposing students to actual jazz music, real jazz, great jazz, because of what jazz has to teach, which is two things. Basically, own the music. To me, jazz gave music back to the musicians. Black music, African American, comes from Black America, went around the world in recordings, changed everybody's hearing. Everybody came back with a new sense of music from jazz music. So it teaches basically two things. Master your instrument, master musical language on the instrument, and be yourself. Tell your own story. Don't imitate. And by the way, that's one reason why I love playing with Glenn. I don't mean to embarrass Glenn, but anyway.
Well, same here.
Well, Glenn, John talked about what he likes to instill into younger players and how mastering the instrument and some other things. What are you hoping that John will bring to your students when he's here for a very short time?
Oh, I just want them, number one, to be able to hear him play because he's such a unique player. He's really one of the greatest jazz trumpet players in the world, and nobody knows about him. And so there's a reason for that, and we could talk about that in the music business class.
But also, Glenn, it was funny in the one review that I read of Timely, the record we did a while back, the reviewer said, "And John Dirth is on the record. Everybody's hip to him." And I didn't really know quite how to take that.
So we did a live recording in a club. This was in 2015. It's our latest recording, Timely. The students have heard that. My students have heard that record, and they're real excited about hearing John. But just to be able to talk to him, and the trumpet players, to be able to talk to him about trumpet and how he approaches the instrument, it's very unique. And anytime you can expose these kids to a professional musician, they're going to grow.
John, I think I'll go with you on this one, but either one of you can answer it. Since jazz is April Appreciation Month, you know, we've talked to a lot of people on GLT this month, jazz cats, right? Young jazz players, and even with Dennis McCrell, who was at ISU last weekend. You know, and I kind of put it to them that, you know, jazz has got a bad rap over the last number of years, even decades, right? There's always the jazz is dead mantra, and there's always, you know, where's jazz going, things like that. But to a person, they are bullish on jazz. And you're feeling the same way, John?
I do. And listen, let me just go back a little bit and say, you know, why would I invite Glenn to be a guest at my school, which we did a while back? The thing is, what I value about it more than anything is somebody who is thinking for themselves, also somebody who has a damn sense of humor. You know, Glenn has this amazing sense of humor about the music. He's also one of the freest players. And that's what I'm trying to teach these kids. What I hate about jazz education and the jazz education racket, as I like to call it, and all education is a bit of a racket. You know, you've got to really train the students to understand that you are working for them. They're hiring you to teach them something. They should take that more seriously as the
boss of them. But, you know, the thing of it is, this music ends up being very repetitive, codified. Everybody's trying to learn the same thing to pass the Jazz Police Academy test. And Glenn Wilson does not care one bit about that. He's, like, not even thinking of, you know, chord changes or anything half the time, just hearing and playing totally free from his own mind. That, to me, is the essence of what jazz should be.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Two voices, Glenn Wilson, the jazz program director at Illinois Wesleyan University, and John Durth, who's the director of jazz performance at the University of Virginia. And John Durth is in town tonight to play at Illinois Wesleyan University. You talked about traditional jazz. You talked about, you know, sticking with the Jazz Police or trying to avoid the Jazz Police. What I hear from a number of younger jazz groups, young students that are just getting out of school, or even a little bit older, is some different sounds, and they're more incorporating different genres into their jazz, whether it's rock or R&B or some other things, as opposed to sticking to the classics, right? Is that kind of the direction jazz is going on a commercial level?
It is, I think, and people are trying to play more modal tunes without changes and more odd meter tunes and rockish tunes, and let's record a song from Nirvana and let's do this and that. That's fine for them, you know, that's their music. If they hear that, they should always reflect what they hear and what they grew up with. They should do that. But some of this stuff, you know, Kendrick Lamar, and they call that jazz, you know, cursing and running around and acting silly. It's kind of an interesting thing. Robert Glasper has some really interesting things going on, but I don't know if I would call it jazz, but Miles Davis didn't call his music jazz either. So,
and right, we don't like the word a lot of times.
Yeah.
We really don't.
So how do you feel about that, John?
Well, I feel that jazz has always moved forward by incorporating everything. It's sort of like omnivorous. There's nothing jazz couldn't digest. In theory, I think. And I think that it's really important for young people to be in touch with their own cultural, you know, reality. But when I talk about the Jazz Police, I'm not talking about kids not playing traditional jazz. I'm talking about people who don't understand that this music is supposed to be about self-expression and about creating yourself as an artist. That's the essence of this music, not what we, you know, tend to start thinking, which is, how do I get to be like Charlie Parker? I mean, the only way you're going to be like Charlie Parker is to be Charlie Parker. That's what this music also has to teach. You know, Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, everyone else is taken. Jazz music reflects that. And the real jazz reflects that. And if real jazz, or anything you want to call, you know, American, black, originated, you know, improvised music, whatever the heck, it's got to come from within a person genuinely to be authentic, in my view. And I'm looking for authentic. I'm looking for authenticity all the time.
John Durth, he's on the phone in his home state of Virginia. Glenn Wilson, the head of the Illinois Wesleyan Jazz Program, is in studio here on GLT. I'm John Norton. Let me give you even a little bit different angle as we're staying on the education angle. I had a recent conversation with the pop rock group Red Scars. Glenn, I don't know if you're familiar with those guys.
Yes, they're students of mine.
Okay, they were students of yours. That's what I was going to get.
Still are. The drummer still is.
Okay, well, most of them are IWU alums who said that their training in jazz and classical music at Wesleyan helped make them better pop rock songwriters.
Sure.
Glenn and John, does somebody have to come into the jazz program and want to be a jazz player, or can they come in and become a more sophisticated songwriter?
Oh, yeah, any of that and all of that. And Wesleyan, of course, is a small school, so a lot of my students are not even music majors, and they have other things going on, you know. And
same with my school, although it's a big school.
Yeah. So the jazz is something they do because they want to do it, and hopefully I make it fun and educational for them, and they feel they're growing as musicians. But certainly with what Red Scarves does is, you know, influenced by jazz and the fact that they can play their instruments to a certain level, and they know more than three chords, and, you know, they have some interesting harmonic progressions, and the tunes are well written. And, you know, I always tell the students when I used to teach music business at U of I that, you know, just be yourself, that the only music you can make that no one else can make, and if it hits, great, and if people enjoy it, great, but you're still going to be, you know, as John said, expressing your artistic self, and that'll always shine through.
John Durth, I want to go backwards just a little bit. And basically, you learned at the foot of your father, right, as a really young kid?
Yeah, I did. I mean, my dad, a famous story that he took me home from the hospital and when I was born, and played me 17 records, 78 records that he had chosen. And I know the first one was Duke Ellington's Caravan, which was very good choice, and I'm sure it wasn't conscious, but my mother was Jewish, he was not, and just had all of those sounds in it, you know, so... Yeah, I learned about music from a man who knew nothing about music technically, but understood it with his ears better than many people I've ever met, and the excitement about it was palpable always. So I caught the bug from him, that's true. I really began to learn a lot about music from a teacher in Milford, Massachusetts named Boots Mazzulli, who played with Stan Kenton. And I hope this isn't too much for your listeners, but when I was 14 years old and went to my first lesson, he was very eager to point out to me that this music that I was trying to play was very closely aligned to my sexual identity, and that he wanted to know if I had hit puberty yet, and if I had, which I had, he said, that's how you play your horn, do you know what I'm talking about? I really thought that was one of the greatest music lessons I ever learned, and I try to gingerly and gently impart that information to people as I can, because what I do feel is that music is biological, that it's part of everybody, and we basically screw people up with it because little kids all have kind of a dream of music, and then the minute we start teaching them, we often ruin that, and then it's a triage. Who can survive this training and still be a musician? So that's my theory. I'm doing a lot in my town with kids who can't afford music lessons, giving them instruments and just letting them play free music, and I call it the precognitive conservatory orchestra. But Wayne Shorter met us and lectured my kids about music and life, and he was thrilled with what we were doing, so that was pretty cool.
University of Virginia Jazz Performance Director John Durth speaking with GLT's John Norton. He also spoke with Illinois Wesleyan Jazz Director Glenn Wilson. Durth is the guest artist with the IWU Jazz Ensemble tonight at Westbrook Auditorium. The music begins at 8 and the concert is free. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it at NPR One or your favorite podcast app. That's also where you can find sound ideas heard on WGLT Normal. Thanks to Judy Valente, Ryan Denham, and John Norton for their help today. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.